And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have a really interesting program planned for you today with two fascinating interviews out of the archives. One of them looks back at Gene Tunney, one of the greatest heavyweight boxing champions of the world, looking at his unlikely friendship with playwright George Bernard Shaw. In part two, a history of board games. Here's part one. I am so honored that for the next few minutes, I speak with Jay Tunney. And that last name is a famous name in the annals of boxing. Jay Tunney's father was James Joseph Gene Tunney. And he was world heavyweight boxing champion in the mid-1920s. In fact, he defeated the legendary Jack Dempsey twice. And Gene Tunney was much more than a superb boxer. He was also a great gentleman and a learned man. And someone who, at the height of his fame, was one of the best known men in the entire world. And just after his retirement from professional boxing, Gene Tunney crossed paths with another very, very famous learned man, George Bernard Shaw. And a book which has been written by Jay Tunney, one of Gene Tunney's sons, explores in particular the unlikely friendship between these two gentlemen. An unlikely friendship, really not at all. Because when it comes to what was important to these two men, in fact, there was every reason for them to be the best of friends. And indeed, although some 40 years separated them in age, they were good friends over the course of two decades, right up to the end of George Bernard Shaw's life. And in this fascinating new book called The Prize Fighter and the Playwright, we learn a great deal more about these two men and about their warm friendship and their regard for one another. The book is published by Firefly Books, and it includes a number of very, very interesting photographs, many of which have never been published before. And again, I am so honored to be speaking for the next few minutes with one of the sons of Gene Tunney and the author of this book. Jay Tunney, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg, very much. It's a pleasant to be here.
Tell us first, just if you would, a word about what it was like to grow up the son of such a famous father. What was that like for you and for your siblings?
Well, actually, it may have been a little different the way we did it than the children of other celebrities. One thinks immediately of the West Coast when we say that. Children of many of those celebrities have a harder time. I don't quite know why. But I think that Dad went out of his way to make sure that we were treated as normally as possible. And therefore, he led a quiet life himself and a rather a non-public life after he retired from the ring. And tried to become a normal citizen after that, as by way of being somewhat of a writer and also a businessman. And his wife and he wanted it that way, and they produced four children, and we were really quite normal. I never thought of myself really as a celebrity son, particularly most of my teenage life, until I really got away from home when I was about 18, did I ever really feel that way. But that was my mother and dad's choice, personal choice. They knew what they were doing on that score.
So tell us to what extent you felt temptation to follow in your father's footsteps when there were such different footsteps to follow. I mean, you could have emulated your father in several different respects because, of course, he was this fascinating, multifaceted Renaissance man. What did you feel like you most wanted to emulate in your famous father?
Perhaps just exactly that, kind of a Renaissance man. That's that's quite a playful. I didn't really start thinking in that way until later in my life, until I was in my 50s. Maybe that's a little late, but I was always an entrepreneur, and in business and in politics, which I spent a bit of time in. And I always felt I had a solo act going, and I did. And I was over in Asia for, you know, the better part of 18 years, 20 years, putting together challenging new frontiers in South Korea by bringing them premium ice cream over there for the first time, and then being a shipping man out of Hong Kong with a Chinese partner, ship owner partner, and I did a lot of things like that, and even drilled or explored. I didn't drill actually, but I explored for oil in Burma before it was Myanmar back in early 1970s, and I got a good taste of what it was like to be lonely and be out there by yourself. And I suppose that, in a sense, was being a Renaissance man. I had been in politics in California, too, helping my brother at one time become United States Senator back in 1970. And I had these experiences, and I'd lived in other countries beside the United States, and it was a very broadening feeling, a very broadening effect on me and my personality. And it allowed me, I think, in the end, to finally step into writing a book about Dad, this book, and about Shaw, and understand a lot more now that I could have then I could have before had I tried a shot at it 30 years ago or so when I didn't know as much. And so I think this is what I got from Dad more than anything. It was kind of challenging new frontiers always.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the genesis of this book. I mean, is this something you have considered doing for a long time? And is there any particular reason why now this book appears?
Well, it's something that was cropping and developing in my own mind, and in also my mother's mind, and a good friend of the family, a former ambassador to Sweden, Mr. Frank Forsberg from Connecticut, and he was a great friend of Dad's, and he wanted to see a good story, a very good story written about Dad by somebody who really knew Gene Tunney. And I think maybe 12 years ago, my mother was showing that same side to her that she would have liked to have seen me try to take a shot at Dad and write about him as somebody that really knew who he was and had that advantage. And so that's where it really, it's been cropping up. It's been coming for the last 20 years, I think, 25 years. There has been a book written about him, maybe one or two books, actually, but none by somebody that could get under Dad's skin, so to speak. And that's basically it. And my mother approved it and liked the angle I was taking on doing a book on Sean and Tunney, which revealed a side to Dad that most people never really knew much about. And, yeah.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Jay Tunney. And Jay Tunney's father, Gene Tunney, was heavyweight boxing champion of the world. And, of course, a participant in one of the most famous boxing matches in history. The book explores that and more, but the sort of unique angle of this particular book written by Jay Tunney is of his father's friendship with George Bernard Shaw. Mr. Tunney, how did you go about writing this book in terms of learning even more about your father and his life and this friendship with Mr. Shaw? I mean, learning even more than you already knew, just as, of course, one of his children and as a member of this family. To what sort of resources did you turn to deepen your understanding of your father?
Well, there are a few answers to that. The main one being we had our own archive here, our own library, in my mother's and father's home in Stamford, Connecticut, and I was able to, with great resolve, dig into all that. There were many communications between Shaw and Dad, and there were all the plays and writings, the essays, many of the essays Dad had in his library there that Mother became the custodian of after Dad's death in 1978. And she was able to direct me and help me and with all kinds of things, became a primary source. And that was very important to me, and her takes on things that had to do with Dad and Shaw way back at that period of time were very important to the book, because it gave me allowed me to be there and be present at the scene, so to speak. I had no tapes or anything like that for a period that happened 85 years ago. And so that was very, very important to me. And then the other, to get a grasp on Shaw from not just my family's point of view, but from Shaw's point of view, I have become very close to the Shaw Society, the International Shaw Society, and the Shaw Festival, particularly up in Canada, in Ontario, Canada, Niagara on the Lake. There's a wonderful repertory theater there that does, called the Shaw Festival, and it concentrates on Bernard Shaw's plays. And I have become on the board up there and become a great advocate of the professionalism of that place. And I go up, and my wife and I are up there all the time, and I've learned tremendous amounts about George Bernard Shaw from that experience of the last 10 years.
One of the things that is most intriguing about your father and what he and your mother experienced during their courtship and honeymoon was just how incredibly famous they were. And for all the ways in which we might find disquieting the media scrutiny that celebrities undergo today and the paparazzi trailing them wherever they go, in a sense, your parents experienced all of that and more. And I suspect that as you did your research, you came to probably an even more profound appreciation for just how glaring the spotlight was for these two young adults.
Well, it's very true, Greg. I mean, shockingly so, as a matter of fact, particularly with the way, when one considers the way we were brought up, which is a certain amount of privacy. And but there was a tremendous blast of publicity at that time. I guess it had something to do with the invention of radio at just that time, right in the middle of the 1920s, the swinging 20s. And radio, the early crystal sets, and then the radio came into being, and just broadcasting to tens of millions of people that never had, that had never happened before, that people could get in on the show right there as it was underway, and then the 60 million people were listening to Dempsey and Tunney at that time, the 1927-1926 period. And my gosh, all of a sudden, Gene Tunney's name and Jack Dempsey's name was all over the world. They were well known. That was the first in history that there was such a gigantic amount of publicity and fame that spread so quickly. So Dad suddenly found himself as one of the most lionized men in the world, and practically could go anywhere and somebody would have known all about him and treated him in an innocent way like a real hero. None of the cynicism had yet been able to start in. That took at least another 60 years for that to happen, but with television and everything coming on after that. But the innocence of it was what was so tremendous, of true no heroism, simply because they were celebrities of that moment.
Hmm.
And yeah.
Your father, of course, came to prominence at the time that Jack Dempsey was still around, one of the most famous boxers in all of history. And, of course, the two of them were so different from one another, or at least in some very obvious ways were different. Perhaps they shared some similarities beneath the surface, but they were in some respects the Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe of their day. I mean, that I'm a tennis fan, so that kind of rivalry between different opponents is what springs to my mind, and others would come up with probably other similar duels in other sports. Talk for a moment about the startling contrast between them and what the public sort of made of your father, I mean, compared to the much more sort of down-to-earth Jack Dempsey.
Well, that's correctly phrased. He was more down to earth than my dad, and they were very different types altogether. They both came from more or less the same same home front where there wasn't a lot of money and things. They had to work for everything they got, and both of them did, but they took dramatically different methods or ways of getting on and getting ahead in life. And they were, Dad was a city boy, really, from New York City, Greenwich Village, New York, and had maybe what goes with that, being a city boy, a certain I shouldn't say delicacy, but a more refined way of looking at things. Jack was out there in wild Colorado in the country, in the mountains, and they breed them a little rougher and tougher, I think, out there. And I think their personalities reflected that to a large extent. Jack Dempsey would have made a beautiful politician. He was fantastic with people. Dad was a little bit more reserved with people, although Dad could be unreserved when he wanted to be in the right setting. He was altogether as friendly and as pleasant with people as Jack always was. Hmm. But I think Jack approached boxing from what we would call a bit of a hackneyed phrase, the man killer approach, and Dad was more of a, shall we say, a mental approach or a scientific approach. And that, I guess, those two approaches differ in the way that Jack had a wicked punch, and he counted on that punch to do the damage for him to his opponent. And felt that whenever he could call on his beautiful, fantastic left hook or his right cross, that he could do it. Dad didn't approach it that way. Dad knew that his punches were not maybe as powerful as Jack Dempsey, but he had to depend on quickness of movement, in and out, blocking, ducking, and countering. And these were his points of strength. And he had a way of wearing his opponents down. Dad made sure he got in top physical physical condition all the time, more than any other fighter, practically, of this century.
Hmm.
And he just wore them down and punished them constantly, slicing, cutting, and things like that. And before you knew it, their eyes were bleeding all over the place.
You know, one of the photographs that I had never seen before, I so appreciate it because without a single word, it tells us something about your dad as a boxer. It is another photograph of him on the mat, the only time he was knocked down in any of his fights,
right,
in that famous long count with Jack Dempsey.
Yes.
And, I mean, most of us have seen the famous photograph where we're looking at your dad from the front, and he's, of course, on the mat and looking up at the ref, And he just looks there, just kind of like a sack of flour sprawled on the floor. But your book has a photograph I've never seen before of the same moment, but from the back.
Yes.
And we see your father's incredibly powerful shoulders. And it's just amazing. He looks like an entirely different kind of physical specimen. And a little bit later in the book, we see a photograph from later in that fight, and by this point he's pummeling Jack Dempsey, who has completely worn out, and your father looks utterly invincible. I so appreciated the opportunity to kind of have these different views of this famous moment in boxing history.
Well, you bring out a very good point, Greg, because Dad had been building himself up more and more as the 20s went on, as he became heavyweight champion in 1926, and actually the power that he had in his muscles, his arms, his shoulders, by the time he met Jack Dempsey was practically probably as great as Jack Dempsey himself. And what people forget is Dad had 45 KOs. He won 77 fights, but he knocked out 45 people. And people keep forgetting that and not knowing that point. It's just something that just isn't brought out very much. But he was a real fighter. He wasn't just a feather duster, as the sports men like to say or call him. And particularly the sportscasters and the sports writers gave that impression. But it was actually a wrong. At first, it was the right impression, but the last 3 or 4 years, it was a wrong impression.
So we need to spend at least a couple of minutes talking about this friendship between Gene Tunney and George Bernard Shaw. One of the things that made it not as unlikely as it might seem at a glance is that George Bernard Shaw, long before your father came along, had been quite interested in boxing.
That's very true. He actually got an interest in it right away after he emigrated from Ireland to England at the age of 20, back in about 1876, and he ran into another Irish immigrant who was living very near him in London, a fellow called Paquito Beatty, and Beatty persuaded him. Beatty was a poet, but he was a passionate poet and a great fan of boxing. It was one of the great sports he felt at that time, and he got Shaw interested in it. And together they worked out at the gym, and they had a bit of time in the ring, and Shaw actually did get in the ring, and not often. Let's not overdo that, but he certainly got to know boxing. He went to many fights, and he got to know the sport as well as any writer who ever lived.
The moment that they befriended one another came in some ways at the height of your father's fame, although at that point he had retired from professional boxing. And George Bernard Shaw, just a couple of years earlier, had won the Nobel Prize.
That's correct, in 1926.
So one of the things your book suggests is that aside from just sort of shared interests, your father and George Bernard Shaw also had in common this sort of extraordinary name recognition and fame. And probably this in and of itself was another bond for them.
Well, I think so. you know, there were a couple of celebrities and a couple of winners, and you have to have a mutual admiration for each other for that. You know, it's just that doesn't last long if you don't have anything beyond that. And I think what the interesting thing about my story and about what actually was that Dad and Shaw had developed a much stronger friendship than just the surface celebrity. And it was during that period, started in 26, that when they met through Shaw's novel, Cashel Byron's Profession. And they didn't meet until 1928, until Dad retired from the ring. That was the initial kickoff, was really that novel that Hollywood wanted to make a movie out of. And 1926, when Dad was champion, they wanted Dad as the lead role, Cashel Byron. So they asked, they cabled Shaw to see if he wanted to do it, and he didn't particularly want to do it, and he was a little rude about it. And in typical Shavian fashion, he just simply didn't answer. And but it never got off the ground, and Dad had said one or two nasty things about the book. And then Shaw gave with the punch a little bit, realizing what he had in Dad's remarks. But they got to know each other that way through Cashel Byron's Profession, this boxing novel that Shaw wrote in 1882. And a very interesting, actually a very interesting book. But anyway, after they did meet, the boxing became a very pivotal part of their relationship. Shaw admired a champion, and of course, Dad admired a great giant of literature, admired it tremendously. And so they really clicked from that point of view, from those two points of view.
One of the things you talk about in characterizing this friendship, and maybe it's true of some of the other friendships that your father had with people like F. Scott Fitzgerald and H. G. Wells and Ernest Hemingway and so on, is the fact that often in these friendships, your father would want to talk about literature, their world in a sense, and they would want to talk about boxing, his world. And it kind of got me thinking about how intriguing such friendships can be, and also probably to some extent potentially awkward in terms of what are we here for, what are we going to talk about today over this meal we're about to share.
Well, it just depends how well you can talk about the other fellow's field of endeavor and expertise. Dad was really good at that. He was, as you mentioned earlier, an autodidact, which means a self-educated man, ferociously self-educated. And he knew a great deal about life and about things, maybe just as much as F. Scott Fitzgerald did. And so Dad had the same sensitive type nature, delicate sensibilities, that Fitzgerald had. One felt in another lifetime Gene Tunney could have easily been a writer if he had really turned his mind to that instead of spending a lot of it on boxing. The first 13 years of his career were boxing. And so I don't think Dad had trouble. That's why they liked Dad, the boxer. That's why Thornton Wilder loved to have Dad around, because they simply spoke the same language, even though Thornton Wilder couldn't talk about boxing all that much the way Hemingway could. Hemingway could really talk your head off about boxing. Fitzgerald would have liked to have done that. Fitzgerald was just happy to be around Dad as a boxer. He was always thrilled about it. He wasn't around him all that much, but not the way Hemingway was, and the way Thornton Wilder was, and the way Shaw was. But usually it was boxing. That was the key. That was the nexus that brings these fellows together. boxing was a famous sport. It was the sport in those days. You've got to remember, people don't recall that now. There wasn't any basketball to speak of. The only other sport was really baseball and football, of course, but not nearly to the extent that boxing was. And it was really king in those days. And so that's how that worked. And Dad was one of the first around to show that he wasn't a bonehead or something, because I think the caricature was boxers and fighters are all boneheads, and Dad showed he wasn't that at all.
to say the least.
And just because he wasn't a bonehead didn't mean he was a freak either. And so this was always a bone of contention.
Right. It's so interesting to think about. I mean, trying to imagine nowadays a heavyweight boxing champion or any kind of boxing champion going to Yale University and lecturing on a Shakespeare play without notes for 45 minutes, as your father did. I mean,
I agree.
Whoa.
I agree. Oh, yes. It's really something. Yeah. It was William Lyon Phelps who invited him. He was the head of the English department there at Yale, and it invited Dad and gotten to know him in Florida. And they'd gone to one of the training camps where Dad was, and then they got a golf game together, and he invited him. And my gosh, it was one of the made Phelps one of the most famous professors in the world, and Dad too became really famous because of this connection to Yale and Shakespeare. Really, really remarkable.
The last question I want to pose to you, we have just a moment or two, I'm afraid, for the answer. At one point, George Bernard Shaw is quoted as saying, "Gene Tunney helped me to plant my feet on solid ground." That was at least one of the ways in which he appreciated his friendship with your father. In what way do you think your father helped George Bernard Shaw plant his feet on solid ground? What was Mr. Shaw talking about?
Shaw's world was the theater, and often in the theater you find fancifulness. In fact, maybe that's its stock in trade. There is fantasy, and many people go into the theater just for that purpose, to kind of get away from reality, so to speak. The reality of life. And I think Shaw was the people that he saw and hung around with, to a large extent, were people from the theater. I think other playwrights and directors and actors, particularly actors and actresses, and they'll find people, they live in a bit of another world. And I think when Dad came around Shaw, there was a great a tremendous feeling of a real person being in Shaw's midst for a brief time when Dad would come to visit a day in St. Lawrence or in Venice or Brioni, where they were. And there was a sense that this is a real champion, a real person who have done real things. And I think that's what that expression was meant. And he talked like a real person, and he wasn't a put-on. Dad was not a put-on. Shaw admired that ingenuous quality of Dad's.
That and many more insights found in this fascinating book called The Prize Fighter and the Playwright, Gene Tunney and George Bernard Shaw. This book, generously pointed with photographs, many of them you likely have never seen before. The book is published by Firefly Books, and its author, Jay Tunney. Jay Tunney, I thank you so much for this privilege and honor of speaking with you, and thank you for writing such a fine book.
Thank you so much, Craig. It's my pleasure, believe me.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we talk about something which I suspect is near and dear to many of you, board games. And we're going to be talking to someone who loves board games probably more than all the rest of us put together. His name is Ian Livingston. He has more than 1,000 games in his own personal collection. He co-wrote the game book series Fighting Fantasy, co-founder of the games company Games Workshop, and is responsible for a new book called Board Games in 100 Moves, 8,000 Years of Play, which covers the thousands of years in which human beings in one way or another have been playing board games. And we will find out a little bit about what is ahead as we continue to sail into the 21st century playing games of all different types. Ian Livingston, we welcome you to the morning show.
Yeah, good morning.
Tell us, first of all, where did your own love of board games begin? Are we talking about typical games that children love, like Candyland and the like?
Well, it wasn't Candyland. In fact, Candyland was not very popular in the UK. It was a huge USA phenomenon.
Ah.
So my love of games started at school with playing games like Monopoly. I also played chess for the school. And I never stopped playing. You know, you're never too young to start, and I don't think you're ever too old to stop playing games. And when I moved to London, I shared a flat with two old school friends, and we all shared an interest in games and played them all the time and thought, wouldn't it be great if we could somehow turn our hobby of playing games into a business? And that's how Games Workshop started, and we actually launched Dungeons & Dragons in Europe back in 1975. But I just love everything about games. You know, play is natural. When we arrive in this world, we learn through play. We interact through play, and it's just a great battle of wits between like-minded people.
Very good. How would you use this term when we're talking about games that we play, in a sense, on a table or sitting around various chairs in a circle versus something that we play on a screen? When a game is actually on a screen, on our tablet or our phone, in your mind, is it still a board game or is it a different kind of game?
It's still play. And play in human terms is that as we create rules so we can decide that we have winners. You know, animals in nature don't have rules, they just play. But we like to win. So whether it's on a screen or on a board, we like to have winners and we like to achieve and make deals and interact and have all that social fun playing together. And there's actually been a huge rise in board games, a revival in board games, strangely, at the time when video games have never been so popular. I mean, the global industry now for video games $150 billion a year, but at the same time board games have been revived thanks to Kickstarter, where people can get games made through crowdfunding. They can learn how to play online through various board game sites. There are review sites, and of course e-commerce. People can buy games through Amazon and the like. So there's never been a better time to access board games and have this great enjoyment and with people you enjoy playing with. And also, which is quite strange as well, is that, well, not strange, I think, is that it's a reaction to, if everything is digital, we feel as humans that something is lacking. We like physical. So there's also been a revival in vinyl, and there's been a revival in physical books, and of course there's been a revival in board games.
One of the most astonishing aspects of your book is that it helps us understand what a long history we are talking about, far longer than I think the average person would ever imagine. Explain just a little bit about the very earliest evidence we have of human beings doing this kind of play and what kind of artifacts survive to sort of point the way to this.
Well, games played on stone, where we used to play, you know, thousands of years ago, scratching game boards into the dirt and using sticks and stones as pieces. But the rules were never written down, of course, so we've no idea how those games were played. But then in the Middle East, from around about 8,000 years ago, there were stone boards dug up again, but with no pieces. But the first earliest recorded board game is a game called Senet, which dates back from 5,000 years ago. You know, long before the wheel was invented, we were playing games. And games like Senet was a race game, moving pieces along a board, were enjoyed by the Egyptians and everybody in the Middle East. And in fact, Tutankhamun had four sets of Senet in his tomb when it was discovered. And so it's not a recent phenomenon, but it has been a great boom in recent years, and particularly in the United States, being some fantastic, well-known inventors and, of course, publishers of board games that we know today, like Monopoly and Candyland, as you mentioned, and Scrabble. But I think it just reflects culture and human beings love to play together.
Mm. One of the hallmarks of your book is that it takes us, in a sense, behind the scenes as some of the most iconic games in history have been created. And in several instances, we are talking about games that became supremely popular and successful, but which had, in one reason or another, very halting beginnings. And in one or two cases, we're talking about blockbuster best-selling games that nearly never got out of the starting gate. Maybe you could share with our listeners a couple of your favorite stories about some of these slow starters that ultimately became real champions in the history of board games.
Well, of course, I just mentioned Monopoly a few minutes ago, is that that actually was a derivative of a game called The Landlord's Game, which was designed by a woman called Elizabeth McGee, who who manufactured a few sets herself in around about 1903. She didn't have much success with it. She patented the game, showed it to Parker Brothers, who rejected it. And it was a little bit abstract, to be honest. But nevertheless, it had a certain appeal, because this was the very first game where things actually happened on the board. Before the Landlord's Game, all the Victorian games had just been simple race games where you roll a dice and move your piece around the board, and that was about it. There was no strategy, and it was just pure luck. But with the Landlord's Game, you could actually develop the piece. You could buy or rent properties on the board. But tragically, it was never a success. But Charles Darrow, who lived in Pennsylvania, he'd got himself a copy, or he'd seen a copy of the game and made his own copy. And there were a lot of derivative games created at the time. And Charles Darrow called his game Monopoly. And he developed it, and he added local place names to the squares. And it had it was a lot more kind of user-friendly, and showed it to Parker Brothers. Long story short, they bought the rights to it, and they subsequently bought any remaining rights that Elizabeth McGee had. And, of course, we all know, Monopoly went on to become a huge multinational success story all over the world, and Charles Darrow did very well out of it, whereas Elizabeth McGee, not so much. Scrabble is another case that was almost, it was made by designers. They couldn't get games made. Alfred Butts made a few copies, didn't sell, and in the end licensed the game, and it was a huge success. I think one of the most funny stories is Twister. Mm. It was originally called Pretzel, and Milton Bradley got hold of it, and they were about to discontinue it, but their PR company had already booked a series of shows for it to appear on, including the Johnny Carson Show. And he played Twister with Eva Gabor, and it was instantly sold out the next day all over the United States, and they ended up having to print like 40,000 a week just to keep up with the demand for a game that was about to be discontinued. So it's quite amusing that some of the biggest titles were almost never made it.
Hmm. One thing that is interesting to me is how one can go into a game store and be confronted by literally hundreds of games, and yet we're really not talking about hundreds of different games. We're talking about maybe several huge genres of which there are many variations. How many genres are we talking about that have spawned many games within them?
Well, there's lots of genres and subgenres these days. Years ago, it was simple race games, as I described, moving your piece around the board. Then things start to happen on the board, and then decided to have more themes attached to the game. So you started having war games and business games and word games. And then beyond that, the strategy or the abstract games became subsets of worker placement games, games like card games where you're building a deck, and so there's more and more subsectors as people trying to find a new genre in which to exploit. I mean, last year at Essen in Germany, they had 180,000 people attend the show, and nearly 2,000 new games were launched. Now, clearly not all those are going to be successful, but people are so excited about the possibility of new gaming franchise coming along that they're motivated to create new games. And again, one of the most successful titles in recent years was Ticket to Ride, invented by Alan Moon in the US. You know, they sold millions and millions of copies, and this is a very elegant railway game where you're building rides, you're taking your trains across initially the United States, and now they've got maps for all parts of Europe and the rest of the world. So there's great potential to be successful in board games today.
Right.
The power of the internet.
And I think there's nothing more exciting than when you find a brand new game that really is new, not just another variation on Trivial Pursuit or another variation on something else you've played, but a game that has truly never existed before. And your book kind of helps us explore what it takes to create that kind of a game. In your own considerable collection, is there a particular game that you especially prize, maybe because it is particularly rare or valuable?
Well, I wouldn't keep it for its value alone. I would keep one for the enjoyment it gives, because you know I buy games because I like them, not because they're going to increase in value over time. And trying to choose one, I've always asked this question. It's a bit like asking me what's my favorite child, and I've got four. So I think the one I'd have to keep would be an original Dungeons & Dragons set, which is still in its shrink wrap, which I got many, many years ago, back in, say, we launched Dungeons & Dragons in Europe in 1975.
Wow.
So I guess it would be that.
And how about, is there a favorite game that you and your children enjoy playing together?
Not all my children enjoy playing games. I mean, some of them are growing up now, but of course. But we like playing Dungeons & Dragons. We like playing Monopoly, some of the classics. But the Ticket to Ride was one. Carcassonne was another. Catan was another. More recently, we've been playing a game called Splendor. But there's always something for everybody in the family. But talking about classics, you know, classics only come along every now and then, ones that kind of milestones in gaming history. And that's what we tried to describe in the book about the way Monopoly changed the landscape, how Scrabble changed the landscape, how Dungeons & Dragons changed the landscape.
Mm.
And then you know, we know there's going to be more in the future, but we're not too sure when or what it will be.
That's part of what makes it all exciting. Where would we be without our wonderful games? And your book helps us explore all of that. Board Games in 100 Moves, 8,000 Years of Play, published by DK. Ian Livingston, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for giving the world this wonderful book.
Thank you very much indeed. Life is a game.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation with Jeffrey Korzenick, the author of a really remarkable book called Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. Jeff Korzenick has worked extensively in the field of encouraging companies to hire people with criminal records and the